are listening to a free version of The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Have I got the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Thursday, December 18th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal. No longer in the literal and never having been in the metaphorical shadow of the New York Times. Now, from the heartland of America, Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, author of An Indigenous People's History of the United States. Also on the program today, Cuba Libre. Is everybody ready to, well, actually not quite, get the cigars and the rum? Send Fat Burger down to Cuba? Also on the program today, we mentioned it yesterday briefly. I think it was in the funner half. The news was breaking. Huge victory for anti-fracking forces in New York State. This is massive. And the real question is, not only is this massive for New York, the announcement of a ban on fracking, but because it's for health reasons, or at least ostensibly, what are the implications going to be across the country? In other words, as far as I can tell, New Yorkers don't have, by virtue of being, of living in New York State, some type of inherent immunity to the health dangers of fracking. So what's it going to mean across the country? We shall see. And yes, folks, I know this is going to change your weekend plans, but that movie, The Interview, has been scrapped by Sony, or at least its national release. And amidst at least a confirmation or at least a report from the FBI that it was, in fact, North Korea that was directly behind the hack into Sony servers, which has given us all these wonderful emails that I don't really care about, and all this other information, I guess a couple, the script to the James Bond thing, that I think may actually get me to click on something in the near future. But it is, it's a little bit, well, there's a lot of actually disturbing aspects to this story. It's easy to, I think, dismiss it because it's sort of Hollywood-centric. But and I don't know that Sony has particularly great internet defenses or firewalls. My understanding is their security was pretty bad. But even still, apparently North Korea has been able to wreak some havoc in places like South Korea. And this, it gives you a little taste of what we could be seeing in the future, right? Where maybe the entire, by the time Saul is doing the Majority Report, maybe even, I would say probably by the time Myla is doing the Majority Report, it could be that every other story is about, well, the Eastern Seaboard's grid was shut down because of an internet hack And the show is being brought to you via carrier pigeon because of another hack, et cetera, et cetera.
It's also more so how they're responding to being to the hack. That, to me, is the big deal, not so much the hack itself.
Well, I guess. But, I mean, you know, the well, we can talk about those details. But in some ways, this is the future of asymmetric warfare. As Michael might say. All right, we got to take a break. We got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. And just a reminder, folks, it is your memberships that make this show possible. If you have the financial means, I know this is a tough time of the year for finances, but if you have the means, please head over to jointhemajorityreport.com or majority.fm and sign up. Also, best ofs, we're about to shut it down, folks. If you want to get into the best of sweeps, and you know what, maybe we even mention who give us the we will mention who gives us the tip. Email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Tell us what you want to hear in the best of. If we use it, we will cite you. All right, folks, be right back with Roxanne Dunbar
that guy
Ortiz. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, a professor emerita of ethnic studies at California State University, author of several books. Her latest is An Indigenous People's History of the United States. Welcome to the program, Roxanne.
Thank you, Sam.
So let's I want to start with the I guess, well, I mean, let's start at the beginning. But before we get through, because I want to cover some of the aspects of the history that you document here that I think are surprising to some people. But in general, I mean, tell us what the reason and what is involved with, I guess, taking a different perspective on our history and why it's so necessary. And our history, I mean, in terms of the United States.
I don't consider this an alternative history, but rather the true history of the United States. It is from the indigenous people's perspective, but without that, almost any interpretation of U.S. history is deeply flawed and doesn't disturb the hardcore origin myth of the United States, that it was born as a, well, they admit now, a flawed democracy, a flawed system because there was slavery, and, you know, there were slave owners doing it, and because of the civil rights movement, it has certainly changed since I was in high school and studied history in the 1950s. It has changed, but it hasn't really disturbed the core origin myth of this birth of a beautiful republic that that was just the beginning of the seed that was planted, and then we get into Howard Zinn's history of people's struggles that have made the country what it is. But then you have to ask, well, what is it? And you have to then say that, well, all of these things, which many historians do, say everything started with World War II and the secrecy and the CIA and the Cold War. That's when everything went off the tracks. And then you have to go back and you have to look at imperialism of Latin America and the Pacific. You have to leave out so much stuff. Then you go back, and what you find is that originally these 13 little British colonies that became independent and bound together in a federation had as their goal from the beginning mapped out and documented in the Northwest Ordinance before the Constitution the expansion to the Pacific, you know, that this was the goal. This was being prevented by the British with their proclamation of 1754 that said the settlers had to stay on the coast and could not go over the mountain range, that was going to stay Indian country. And then, of course, Spain and France and other European powers were in the rest of the continent. And so this it isn't just the what you could call the original sin of genocide to establish those 13 colonies, but the continuation for 100 years of unrelenting wars against Native nations to take the continent. So what I say is everything that is now, that is the United States government, and particularly its military history is usually left out, so we always see these wars as some bump in the road. And I think there's a big opening now for for clarifying that, because it looks like we have endless war now, but we always have. We just hadn't really seen it as blatantly as we see it now, is that they actually say there's no end to these wars. The war on terror will go on and on and on and on. And so it started with a war on terror. From the very beginning, those who were called the terrorists were the Indians.
Right.
Who were preventing settlement. So the counterinsurgency that developed very early, it developed actually in the British colonies by the settlers. And then you have Washington and his militia and all these people, their militias. Well, why did they have militias? You know, who were they fighting? They were fighting the Indians, you know, directly, without the redcoats or anything else. They were making, you know, expanding on their own within those colonies that had been established and recognized by Britain as colonies, but they weren't really settled because Native people were there, farmers. So our present military is built on these wars, and that's something that is rarely considered except by people who think it's a great thing, you know, that's the case, that the Indian Wars were valiant and are the basis of the U.S. military, and those are mostly very militaristic right-wingers.
So if I could restate, I mean, or just to boil it down, I mean, what we can see from this actual history, as opposed to the sort of the myth, is that the war against essentially the natives was building a structure that we are still in, a legacy that we are still in many ways confined by, or dictated to by, or is a sort of a structure by which we still live, as opposed to it being an anomalous sort of brief period where we committed genocide, and then once we got that out of the way, we started afresh on some level.
Right. It's tragic. Most people now will, you know, say, well, at least liberal historians and progressives, this is tragic, you know, they go into depth how horrible it was, but it happened, you know, and that's it. And not look at, well, what are, not only that they're still Native peoples, you know, and they're still living under a colonial system in the United States, but also that it is the very basis of the structure and the behavior of the United States and the world, and domestically. And if you combine that, it's necessary to combine that with the other side of that core, which is slavery, plantation slavery, and private property, because it wasn't just labor that slavery was about. It certainly was about free labor, unpaid labor, forced labor, but it was also about bodies as commodities. So you have land, native land as commodity, native bodies as commodity. Those two things are what built the initial accumulation of capital in the independent United States. And, of course, the Cotton Kingdom, that's now being recognized as the very basis of the formation of U.S. capitalism,
right,
not industrial revolution.
Well, start at the beginning, because the your first chapter, Fall of the Corn, really gives a sense, I think broadly speaking, my if I had to guess, this audience in a broad sense has, an awareness and certainly a sense that there was a deep injustice committed and perhaps a rolling one. But what I think most people don't fully understand was, which is central to that myth, was that when the Puritans essentially showed up in the United States, there was in fact a civilization, and there were nations, and you follow the corn, it gives us a sense that there was sort of an infrastructure. Will you talk about what existed in terms of roads, in terms of trade, prior to the arrival of the colonialists?
Yeah, that's also part of the origin myth, going back to the Pilgrims, you know, and the Puritans. They don't like to talk about Jamestown because that was so obviously a brutal mercenary colonialism. But there was an ideology attached to the Puritans, which is they were going into the wilderness to build a land of milk and honey and, you know, all these biblical, the Zion, you know, they used all the Zionist language for their errand, as Perry Smith, the historian, called it, errand in the wilderness, they considered it. And it was a responsibility they were carrying out in their minds. You know, they rationalized it as a responsibility to do this, not just a privilege, let's say, or they just wanted to make money or whatever, own land. So they built this whole ideology around it. And in order to do that, they had to dismiss the civilization that they were colonizing as really human. You know, they're subhuman, just like those who raided for slaves in Africa did not recognize that these were great civilizations. These were many of them Muslims, you know, practicing Muslims with mosques and huge cities. And they were, you know, they had to, and with all of colonialism in India, everywhere else, they have to make subhumans out of the victims of colonization in order to rationalize it. And white supremacy is so tied up in that it's, you know, inseparable from a Euro supremacy. And that still reigns in this country, of course, as we know. So what existed, what got built even in those colonies and throughout the continent could not have happened without an infrastructure already existing. There simply wasn't enough mechanisms, enough power, enough enough of anything to be able to go in. We know that about India. They didn't go into a wilderness. They couldn't even think of that in the 19th century. You know, that wasn't very likely to go over. They simply appropriated. But settler colonialism has to justify not just linking up and dominating economically the colonized, but also eliminating the native in order to take the land. So it's a special kind of colonialism that we see that is a minority of colonialism. It's the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, to some extent Argentina and Chile, as the late Spanish started imitating the Anglos with settler colonialism. But the roads existed, the road networks, trade, vibrant trade, the civilization that is always recognized as having existed in central Mexico is portrayed as this vicious, you know, vicious empire. But it was a huge civilization, still developing. That central government in Mexico was about to be overthrown by many other peoples when the Europeans, when the Spanish intervened. But out of the Valley of Mexico came this unique grain of corn, this nutritious item that existed nowhere else in the world, and it spread from the south of South America to the subarctic, from the Atlantic to the Pacific. And with its spread, it didn't just blow in the wind. It has to be planted by human hands. It was carried and carried through trade routes. So that developed over a period of 10,000 years. And by the time the Europeans came, it was flourishing. And, you know, it's considered three of the seven seats of civilization are in the Americas. There's the Tigris-Euphrates, there's the two in China, and then there's the three in the Americas, in the Andes, in central Mexico, and the whole eastern part of North America was an incredible agricultural paradise, you know, civilizations, towns. At one time they had huge cities, but they devolved into towns, into federated towns, systems that we should really look at now as models of how people can live in the future in peace, you know, and with good social relations, communal land, indigenous socialism.
I just want to be clear, so that people understand. So it wasn't just what we now call America, United States of America, was not just. It wasn't just tribes, nomadic tribes everywhere. There was an infrastructure which. You know, when we look back at history at that period and talk about we're seeing trade routes via ocean and bringing different products from the east to the west, et cetera, the same dynamic was existing here. And when we talk about the roads, we're not talking about hunter paths or
right.
we're talking about roads that have trade stops through them, like in the way that we imagine, you know, the inn, I guess, on the road.
And even towns, you know, dotted along the road.
How were the roads organized? In other words, I know there was a road from Mexico to what is now Canada.
It's all the way to the Bering Strait, actually, all the way to northern Alaska, to western Mexico and the Pacific. What the Pan-American Highway is built over that road. Almost all of our interstate highways are built over, almost all the highways in the whole hemisphere are built exactly where those roads were. So These were appropriated. They were already mapped out. They were already... That's why it wasn't hard for these surveyors like George Washington and later Abraham Lincoln and all going out to, you know, in their pre-colonial projects of mapping the land. It wasn't hard to map because it was already, you know, it was already so organized.
How were they built? I mean, not literally how were they built, but how was it organized in terms of, you know, who would take responsibility for a road that goes that far?
Well, you know, this is one of the unstudied, since very few historians recognize these civilizations, they leave it to archaeologists to reconstruct, and archaeologists are very politically inclined as well in the United States to have a certain interpretation of migrations and development. So what they find, they interpret in a certain way. And, you know, it's called science, but it's pretty imaginative. It's not exactly like astronomy, you know, or physics. So it's a lot of guesswork. And then creating a narrative, and that narrative is always an imperialistic one rather than a one that recognizes. What we really need to have a lot of research on, and I've done some of it in a particular area, is how labor was organized, how work was organized. And where I've studied it at the pueblos of New Mexico, there's still 21 of these city-states in New Mexico that preceded the Spanish conquest. They've been there 10,000 years. And they are farming, you know, agricultural lands. They had lived in larger city-states in the West, in Mesa Verde, but they devolved in this period of devolution that, some interpret as these rise and fall of civilizations. But, you know, that's a European concept. To me, what I saw them doing is devolving, as they saw that they were exploiting the resources, particularly the wood, and that caused erosions from their irrigation works, their huge irrigation works. So they devolved, and they then lived along rivers where they had the main, the irrigation could be off the river rather than, these massive irrigation works that existed in Mesa Verde, you know, prior to the Europeans coming. So they moved into these riverine areas, and that was a lot, you know, centuries and centuries ago. But what I studied there in this book I did on the history of land tenure in New Mexico called Roots of Resistance is I looked at the ceremonial, what's usually been written about as ceremonies, and these ceremonies almost always were around food, and of course corn is the sacred food, and they were organized in such a way as to for equitable distribution through ceremonies. And they had a system of, and they still do, a ditch moss, you know, it's called in English, of the irrigation. And this is, in the concept of Oriental despotism that Marx unfortunately picked up, is to build the pyramids and to build these, you know, these huge civilizations, you had to have slave labor. That may have been true of Egypt, but that was not true in the Americas. That there was, with these irrigation works, I found, and the building of the cities themselves, which were large, you know, and made of stone, and stone had to be collected. And these are people who did not, who did not use animals as beasts of burden, who did all their own carrying and labor. They had serial bosses. The ditch boss for irrigation was a 1-year term. And that authority was absolute in terms of the water distribution to keep it equitable, so war would not break out between the different users of, because this is, you know, a desert with water. Interestingly enough, all of these areas of the world where civilization first appeared were semi-arid or desert areas. So I've always found that interesting as well. You know, that
right, it's a little counterintuitive, right? You would imagine they would grow up around water more.
Right. And Northern Europe was very late in, you know, in being able to feed its people. It really wasn't able to do that until about the, you know, with colonialism in the 19th century, importing things. But they ruined all their agricultural lands with enclosure and turning to grazing and wool, monoculture like that. But the native peoples always kept the varied items. You know, even the corn had about 90 different varieties and colors, as the potatoes did, as the squash did, all the gourds we see now. There are about 100 different shapes that still exist. There are probably many more then, each with a different nutritional value. And they have to be planted together and with the beans as well in order to create the nutrition in the soil. So once that's changed to monoculture, whether it's food crops or textiles, it destroys the land. So they were very good stewards of the land, but they did reform it, remake it. You know, they made it livable for humans, but still respectful of the environment and particularly of animals.
But ultimately, the point is that you have there's clear evidence and indication of a complex system of organizing a society and of a what appears also to be a concerted effort to make that society sustainable. I mean, that is why people sort of create these civilizations, all of which run contrary to the initial myth that allowed for the idea that we're conquering. You know, from the colonialist perspective, we're conquering nature as opposed to we're actually conquering people.
Right. Systems, right?
And so,
yeah, and they picked up, you know, they appropriated the land, but they also appropriated so many practices. You know, the canoe, the birch bark canoe, the log house, all these things that are seen as these great inventions of the pioneers of the United States were all already there. You know, they just
right.
imitated them, or in many cases simply drove the native people out of their towns and took over and lived there in their houses.
You know, it's funny that you say that, because I was just hearing listening to another podcast that was talking about the sort of the American myth of the rugged individualist and Daniel Boone and those type of folks. And, you know, one thing you associate with those great pioneers is not that they were just borrowing technology that was already existed, that they were adopting technology, which runs, of course, counter to this narrative of them being great individualists. Yeah, it's very easy to be an individualist if you have already been presented with the technology and the infrastructure that allows you to go out into the so-called wilderness. But I want to touch on a couple of other aspects. I want to jump to Andrew Jackson for a moment, and because on some level that strikes me as the next major sort of myth building where you have the last of Mohicans and this idea that we were dying out anyways, and you guys we finally hand you the baton.
Right.
Will you talk about that, because that seems to be the next sort of like phase, right? We come in and say we're just conquering the wilderness, and then coincidentally, a lot of these folks, or you know, not quite humans who are here, die off, and then they look to us to maintain their legacy of some sort.
Yeah, they, you know, I think up until that mythology that began developing in the 1820s, you know, a generation after the Revolution, or, you know, more than a generation after the founders, you know, had kind of faded away and there were new ones there, they began constructing a mythology that justified the taking by this gift giving, you know, the gift, what I call the gift giving Indian, that the native people always welcomed these colonists. I don't believe that for a minute, not at, you know, Plymouth Rock or Massachusetts Bay, that these native people welcome these people moving in. I think that is a total myth. They just, you know, they didn't come with an approach that would have received a welcome, let's put it that way. So apparently they did welcome other visitors earlier in time, Irish, Vikings, people who were not there to conquer, probably Japanese, Chinese, Pacific Islanders, maybe people from Africa and India who traveled to the Americas or back and forth. There did not seem to be this problem, but they created this. I mean, it's an interesting myth because it's you know, it's deep in our mentality because of the stories that are read as children. I mean, they're still read, Last of the Mohicans and the Leatherstocking Tales, but then we have the Little House on the Prairie, you know, to kind of update it, and we have the new movie of Last of the Mohicans, a blockbuster. And this is literally an adopted white guy who is handed by his adopted father, the Mohican, the last Mohican, say, yes, we're fading away. We can't survive. It's now in your hands. We give it to you and will it to you, and you take care of it. Well, that's a very handy myth, you know. And
right.
I think,
and it's the passiveness involved in we can't survive, as opposed to we've been killed.
Right. Exactly. And Jackson is, you know, I think he's the most important figure in U.S. history because. Not because he was a psychopath, but I'm not sure that distinguishes him that much, you know, from many of those leaders. But his trajectory from he was a child, he was the spawn of Thomas Jefferson, the great architect, as he's called, of the whole colonial system, and how to get rid of the native people, you know, to appropriate the land and how to expand. And Jackson started out very young, you know, as a head of the Tennessee militia. And these militias, as I said, were they had two roles. Certainly by that time, two major roles. One was because the native people of the Southeast had not been displaced and conquered at all. And the plantation economy had become quite robust by that time. And so they were to, you know, to police, the militias were to police the slaves, to keep the slaves intact, but also to drive the native people out, to, you know, go into their villages fully armed on horseback and simply burn everything down, burn all their crops, burn their storage, and drive them out walking as refugees so that they would have to find someplace else, some other town to settle in. Eventually, of course, or very quickly, many of them went to the refuge of the Everglades, where the Seminole insurgency carried on from 1810 to 1850 three major wars that Jackson led, or the first two he led. Well, the first one he led, and the second one he was president, and the third one was in 1850. But Jackson was first Tennessee militia. He took his militias into Georgia to attack the Muscogee Creeks, to drive them out. So it's created a huge number of refugees, starving, lots of disease that happens, you know, when people are in crowded conditions. And some of them, the younger men, would go and join the insurgency, but the refugees were left astray. And because of his success in doing that, all on his own, without any, even though the Constitution already said that only the federal government could have relations with Native nations, here he was, the head of a Tennessee militia, carrying out these wars against the Native people. And not only was he not punished, he was rewarded with a commission as Major General in the U.S. Army. And then was tasked with, you know, fighting the Seminoles and of course the Creek Muscogees in Alabama. They're trying to clear this area for plantation agriculture to expand, which made the Cotton Kingdom. So that was happening right after the Revolution. There was this total war that continued. In fact, Native people were the main people they were fighting in the war for independence. The British could not have fought as long as they could, you know, did with, you know, just regular troops when the independence forces were using, the separatists were using counterinsurgency methods. The British had, you know, standing troops that didn't do counterinsurgency. So they were mainly, the Native people were fighting like crazy to prevent independence, because it's not that they loved the British so much at all, but it was very clear that their immediate and direct enemy were these avaricious, land-hungry, greedy, slave-owning settlers,
right.
You know, and that the British was the only, you know, that they were far away and could be handled through diplomatic means. And they had restricted, the Indians had won, you know, and the French and Indian War had won that demarcation that the settlers could not go over the mountain range.
So Jackson
became president on this populist wave of taking land. And so he's not an anomaly, you know, he's not just, oh, the bad guy, you know, that should be condemned. He is the key to the development of the United States really being formed from its beginning as a kind of capitalist corporate body. You know, I don't think it can even really be called a republic in any, you know, political sense that we know. It was really formed as a, you know, a corporate body to build wealth.
And when you can do that via genocide, you get put on the $20 bill. That's the thing that amazes me. Is I think that most people don't realize when they look down at that $20 bill that this guy is there basically because he was able to slaughter so many natives that it sort of propelled him and the country forward. I could talk to you for hours about this, and I want to really encourage people. We have a link at majority.fm to the Indigenous Peoples History of the United States. But just I want to wrap up by asking you, you know, what are we going forward with this? What are some of the biggest, if not the greatest benefit to understanding this history and to the idea of not living with these sort of these myths? And just, I guess, is the biggest takeaway that we can learn lessons from the struggle, the ongoing struggle of natives Is it that we can understand our present and our future more by really having a clear, less or more demystified vision of our history? Or is it also, you know, some measure of practical lessons for sustainability on some level? I mean, what's the I hate to make you sort of split the baby in that way, but what is in your mind the most important aspect of those?
Well, the most important aspect is freedom, I think. For people to free their minds of toxic thinking that makes people into, you know, crazy without really having any kind of chemical problem in the brain. As far as I can tell by the science, that there's something going on with the violence in this country that is beyond, way beyond chemical imbalance. and if people learn this, how would they be looking at this police violence that we're dealing with right now, unfortunately, and this uprising that's so important? It's where did this violence come from? It's so ingrained, you know, because the police are basically the those militias made official, put a badge on them and pay them a salary. They did it for free back then, or just for the loot that they could get. And they know that's what they are. They still use the bagpipes. These are mostly Scots-Irish people in these militias. They still use bagpipes for their funerals, you know, police do. It's not because they're all Irish either. So it's, you know, the traditions are so strong, and there's such a gap between the intellectual class in the United States and the settler class and their reproduction. They're not just like, let's say, the apartheid in South Africa, this small group of people who did take over, but they certainly never convinced the majority of the population of their point of view. You know, they had to use extremely oppressive methods to keep people down. Well, the United States has to do that more and more. But it's not, it's all the immigrants who are brought in. They are subsumed with this, their citizenship test, everything. They have to learn, they have to adopt this this point of view of who they are, and then they have to fight in those wars, and they have to then teach that if they're going to get a job as a teacher or if they're going to get a job as a journalist. So it's, you know, it's a toxin that just fills everyone. It's just not just a small group of, you know, say the Tea Party, although those people really do represent the, you know, half my family is from this class of settlers, the Scots-Irish, poor, mostly poor working class of my father's side, and going across the frontier. So I know us well. I know them well, you know. And I understand their point of view, and that doesn't make me sympathetic with it. It makes me say it has to be dismantled, even in the young people of that group of people. But it has to be really challenged. And liberals are always just challenging in ways that don't even come near what the problem is, like the whole gun debate about putting restrictions on guns. Yes, they can do that in Canada and Britain and New Zealand, and it works, or in other parts of the world. Or they don't have gun laws in Switzerland, and people don't kill each other. They don't go around with guns. There are no gun laws at all in Switzerland. There are never any homicides. So it's not just because it's a small country. You know, it's just, we have to really... almost anything you pick up and look at, you know, unless you're, we find our movements just expiring because they get to the end of their rope. You know, the anti-Vietnam War, everything that was coming out there, Even some of it having to do, this is when I started picking up on this counterinsurgency in Vietnam being like the Indian Wars. You know, I was only a graduate student in history then, but the language of it, you know,
right.
Calling it Indian country.
And we see that with our weapons systems as
right.
Well. Well, sadly, we're out of time, but again, the book is, we will link to it at the site, our site, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sam. Bye.
All right, folks. Went a little long again. Just a reminder, this program cannot exist without your support. Become a member today at majority.fm. If you want to support the program in other ways, I think we still have links up there to the Bumbas promotion we were running and the Harry's promotion. Right, guys? And you can check out any post at majority.fm for that. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. All fair trade. Great coffee. Somebody IM'd me yesterday. They had just given the Majority Report blend to their father-in-law, and they said it's great, great coffee. And apparently you can get this Keurig things or whatever it is, these one-off coffee, like, you know, like the K-cups, they call them. But you can make your own, with which I didn't realize. So we're in the market for one of those, I think. Let's get some coffee in this a coffee machine in this place. And of course, if you use the coupon code MAJORITY, you get 10% off. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, reminder, majorityreportkickback.com. You click on the Amazon link. You buy your Amazon stuff through there. You'll notice no difference. We get a kickback. Everybody wins, except for Jeff Bezos. And that, in my mind, is a big win. Don't forget the best of stuff. Give us a review on iTunes. And tomorrow on the program, Cliff Schechter and Tom Sharpling, whose show has returned to the interwaves. I just coined that. 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920 if you want to be a part of the program. You can also IM me through the app, which you can pick up at Majority App. This is where Matt has played the music. There we go. A little late on the trigger. You can IM me through the app or through AIM instant messaging at Majority FM. The app is the easiest way to do it. Majority app. Get the Android or the iOS app. See you in a second.